Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
organizers of the Port-au-Prince International Jazz Festival recently announced that the music event has been postponed. The reason given was an increase in gang activity in the Haitian capital. The festival, usually held in January, brings together musicians from more than 12 countries every year. Melina Sandler is director of the Haiti Jazz Foundation, which organizes the festival. She told the French news agency, "We can't take the risk, either for the 150 musicians, or for our teams, or for the public." Sandler added, "We have been thinking for a while now that it would be difficult to stage a festive event in this context." In recent months, gangs have gone beyond the poorer areas of Port-au-Prince and have increased the number of kidnappings. Their control over the capital regularly prevents secure access to oil stations. As a result, fuel shortages have harmed the transportation industry. Many hospitals, businesses, and schools have been forced to reduce their services. The United States and Canada have suggested that their citizens living in Haiti have an emergency plan to leave the country. Sandler is hopeful that the music festival will take place sometime in 2022. If the situation in the country does not allow for the usual format of concerts over 8 days, we will still have something and it won't be virtual, she said. Sandler added that the festival's Haitian and international partners were considering a program for the end of June. The only time the festival has been canceled was in 2010. That year, a huge earthquake severely damaged Port-au-Prince and other towns on January 12th, killing more than 200,000 people.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the old city of Bethlehem in the West Bank was busy with visitors in the weeks leading up to Christmas. But for the last 2 years, hotels are empty or closed. No one is coming to the shops. A historic piece of woodwork inside the famous Church of the Nativity is being cleaned. However, not very many people will see how good it looks this year. Bethlehem, known from the Bible as the birthplace of Jesus, is inside an area of the Middle East controlled by Israel, known as the West Bank. Israel opened to visitors who have been vaccinated earlier in November, but not many people are coming to Bethlehem. In 2019, the city was busy with people visiting historic places, such as the Church of the Nativity and Manger Square. Aladdin Subbu runs a shop near the square. He said he has no customers. He only opens the door to let in fresh air. For 2 years, no business, he said. It's like dying slowly. The global health crisis reduced visitors in both Israel and Palestine. But the city of Bethlehem's economy depends on visitors, so the situation is especially bad. In the first part of this month, 30,000 visitors came to Israel. In November 2019, over 400,000 people came. There is some government help for business owners in Bethlehem, but not much. Majed Ishak is marketing director for the Palestinian Tourism Ministry. He said the Palestinian government is offering some businesses who depend on visitors from other nations ways to pay less tax and some new training. Ishak's organization is working to encourage more people to come to Bethlehem this year. But Fadi Katan is not hopeful. He is a chef and runs a hotel in the old part of Bethlehem. I don't think tourism will come back very soon, he said. He closed his hotel in 2020 and does not plan to open it before Christmas. Katan said, it will take a long time for the city to recover from the COVID-19 restrictions, and business owners want to be sure they can stay open for a long time if they reopen. I'm Dan Friedel.
Every year around the Thanksgiving holiday, a strange ceremony happens in Washington, D.C. The president stands outside the White House, gives a brief speech, and then officially pardons a turkey. A pardon is a declaration that someone will not be punished. You might be asking yourself, what is the connection between turkeys, Thanksgiving, and grammar? In today's report, we explore what turkeys can teach you about English verbs. In particular, we will show you how Thanksgiving can teach you to use stative verbs. We will also show you the difference between stative and progressive verbs.
The term stative verb refers to a verb that has a stative meaning. In other words, these verbs show or describe conditions or situations that do not do anything but exist. Verbs that commonly have a stative meaning include verbs that show emotional states, such as love and dislike, verbs that describe sense perceptions, such as smell or taste, verbs that show existence, such as seem or look. In the present tense, a verb with a stative meaning is generally used in its simple form. I love turkey, or Americans like turkey, are two examples. Verbs that have stative meanings are generally not used in the progressive tense. So, you will probably not hear a native speaker say, I am loving turkey, or Americans are liking turkey.
Do not fear. We can use our Thanksgiving example To make the point clearer, imagine you are at an American store. You hear a conversation between a customer and a store employee. The customer wants to buy a turkey that weighs 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms. Unlike the turkey from the pardoning ceremony, this turkey will have a sad fate, the dinner table. The conversation you hear might go like this.
How much does that turkey weigh?
It weighs 10 pounds.
How much does it cost?
It costs $20.
In the dialogue, you can hear two examples of stative verbs, weigh and cost. The butcher said, the turkey weighs 10 pounds and the turkey costs $20. In both cases, the verbs have a stative meaning. The butcher is describing a condition or situation that simply exists, the weight and cost of the turkey. Now imagine you are eating Thanksgiving dinner with an American family. You might hear any one of the following sentences.
I love turkey.
I dislike turkey.
The turkey smells wonderful.
The food tastes great.
The turkey seems undercooked.
The turkey looks awful.
All these sentences include stative verbs. You might notice that the verbs are also in the simple present form.
So, why would an English speaker not say, the turkey is seeming undercooked, or I am disliking turkey? Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber are two English grammar experts. They say that, in general, English speakers use the progressive tense only when the subject of the verb actively controls the state or action. In addition, English speakers generally use the progressive only when the verb describes an action or state that happens over an extended period of time. So, you would not hear an English speaker say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," because the subject of the verb, the turkey, does not control its state, being undercooked. For the same reason, you would not hear an English speaker say, "I am disliking turkey," because the verb's subject, I, probably does not have control over the action of disliking turkey. Now, some verbs can have stative and progressive meanings. Consider these examples.
The food tastes good.
The president is tasting the food.
In the first sentence, the food does not control whether it is good or bad. As a result, the verb taste has a stative meaning because it simply describes the condition of the food. In the second sentence, the president is tasting the food. The subject of the verb, the president, has control over his action. In addition, the action takes place over an extended period of time. The president must think about tasting food, then raise the food to his mouth, then consider its quality. So, you could say that the verb taste in this example has a progressive meaning.
The next time you are reading or listening to the news, pay special attention to the verbs. Notice when the progressive form is used and when the simple form is used. Then ask yourself why. Does the verb's subject control the action? Does the action occur over an extended period of time? Or does the verb simply describe a condition that exists? If you are still confused about whether you should use a simple or progressive verb in your own conversations, Conrad and Biber have one tip that might help you. They say that in conversations, English speakers use simple verbs around 120 times in every 1,000 words. Progressive verbs are much less common. They appear fewer than 20 times in every 1,000 words. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On April 9, 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Union General Ulysses Grant. Within weeks, the Civil War would be over. When people in Washington learned of Lee's surrender, they hurried to the White House. The crowd wanted to hear from President Abraham Lincoln. The speech he gave would be one of his last, as Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe explained in our series.
President Lincoln spoke several days after General Lee's surrender. The people expected a victory speech, but Lincoln gave them something else. Already, he was moving forward from victory to the difficult times ahead. The Southern Rebellion was over. Now, he faced the task of rebuilding the Union. Lincoln did not want to punish the South. He wanted to rejoin the ties that the Civil War had broken. So, when the people of the North expected a speech of victory, he gave them a speech of reconstruction instead. On the night of April 11th, Lincoln appeared before a crowd outside the White House. He held a candle in one hand and his speech in the other.
"Fellow citizens," Lincoln said, "we meet this evening not in sorrow, but in gladness of heart. The surrender of the main army of the Confederacy gives hope of a righteous and speedy peace. The joy cannot be held back. By these recent successes, we have had pressed more closely upon us the question of reconstruction." "We all agree," Lincoln continued, "that the so-called seceded states are out of their correct relation with the Union. We also agree that what the government is trying to do is get these states back into their correct relation. I believe it is not only possible, but in fact easier, to do this without deciding the legal question of whether these states have ever been out of the Union. Finding themselves safely at home, it would be of no importance whether they had ever been away."
There was cheering and applause when President Lincoln finished, but less than when he began. The speech had been too long and too detailed to please the crowd. Lincoln, however, believed it a success. He hoped he had made the country understand one thing: the great need to forget hatred and bitterness in the difficult time of rebuilding that would follow the war. The president continued to discuss his ideas on Reconstruction over the next few days. On Friday, April 14th, he agreed to put this work aside for a while. In the afternoon, he took his wife, Mary, for a long drive away from the city. In the evening, they would go to the theater.
One of the popular plays of the time, called Our American Cousin, was being performed at Ford's Theater, not far from the White House. The Secretary of War did not want the Lincolns to go alone. He ordered an army officer to go with them. The President and Mrs. Lincoln sat in special seats at Ford's Theater. The presidential box was above and to one side of the stage. A guard always stood outside the door to the box. On this night, however, the guard did not remain. He left the box unprotected.
President Lincoln settled down in his seat to enjoy the play. As he did so, a man came to the door of the box. He carried a gun in one hand and a knife in the other. The man entered the presidential box quietly. He slowly raised the gun. He aimed it at the back of Lincoln's head. He fired. Then the man jumped from the box to the stage, 3 meters below. Many in the theater recognized him. He was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he hit the stage floor, but he pulled himself up, shouted, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus ever to tyrants, and ran out the door. He got on a horse and was gone.
The attack was so quick that the audience did not know what had happened. Then a woman shouted, "The president has been shot." Lincoln had fallen forward in his seat, unconscious. Someone asked if it was possible to move him to the White House. A young army doctor said no. The president's wound was terrible. He would die long before reaching the White House. So Lincoln was moved to a house across the street from Ford's Theater. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from the president's head. He could not. Nothing could be done except wait. The end was only hours away.
Cabinet members began to arrive, while wild reports spread through the city. The Confederates had declared war again. There was fighting in the streets. An official of the War Department described the situation. The extent of the plot was unknown. From so horrible a beginning, what might come next? How far would the bloody work go? The safety of Washington must be looked after. The people must be told. The assassin and his helpers must be captured.
Early the next morning, April 15th, Abraham Lincoln died. A prayer was said over his body. His eyes were closed. The news went out by telegraph to cities and towns across the country. People read the words but could not believe them. To millions of Americans, Abraham Lincoln's death was a personal loss. They had come to think of him as more than the President of the United States. He was a trusted friend. People hung black cloth on their doors in sorrow. Even the South mourned for Lincoln, its former enemy. Southern General Joe Johnston said, "Mr. Lincoln was the best friend we had. His death is the worst thing that could happen for the South."
Messages of regret came from around the world. British labor groups said they could never forget the things Lincoln had said about working people, things such as, "The strongest tie of human sympathy should be one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues." A group representing hundreds of French students sent this message: "In President Lincoln, we mourn a fellow citizen. There are no longer any countries shut up in narrow frontiers. Our country is everywhere where there are neither masters nor slaves. Wherever people live in liberty or fight for it, we look to the other side of the ocean to learn how a people which has known how to make itself free knows how to preserve its freedom." The assassination of Abraham Lincoln touched the imagination of America's writers. Many tried to put their feelings into words. Walt Whitman wrote several poems of mourning. Here is part of one of them: "O Captain, my Captain."
"Here, Captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head. It is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm. He has no pulse nor will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I, with mournful tread, walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead."
Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the spring. That is the time of year when lilac plants burst into flower throughout much of the United States. One of Walt Whitman's most beautiful poems in honor of Lincoln is called "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed." Here is part of that poem:
"When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. Ever-returning spring, Trinity sure to me you bring, lilac, blooming perennial and drooping star in the west, and thought of him I love. Coffin that passes through lanes and streets, through day and night with the great cloud darkening the land, with the countless torches lit, with the silent sea of faces and the unbared heads, with the tolling, tolling bell's perpetual clang. Here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.